just an editorial note at the beginning of the podcast, we get into spoilers around the 20-minute mark, so stop listening there if you just want our first impressions of the film and come back and finish it after you've watched the rest of the movie. It's not reduced to this like simple narrative structure of, okay, we can figure out which side is right and who we should be aligned with and know that, you know, it's like Paul himself is struggling with this idea of, am I a messiah or am I just a regular guy? And that struggle within himself is an uncertainty that he's grappling with. Hello and welcome to Cinema of Meaning, the podcast from myself, Thomas Flight, and my fellow video essayist, Tom Vanderlinden, that seeks to explore the depths of what cinema has to offer. In this special episode, we are going to be discussing Dune Part 2. For those of you who have not been with us from the beginning, the first Dune was the very first episode of Cinema of Meaning that we ever recorded. And so we kind of wanted to create symmetry by theoretically ending the podcast here with episode 2. So that's something before we get into Dune, we'll discuss a little bit here, which is that this is kind of a farewell announcement of sorts. Mm-hmm. The podcast kind
Long of overdue.
Yes, kind of ended a while ago. We took a break and weren't sure when we started the break whether or not we were going to continue. And then we decided not to. And we announced it to our patrons and then somehow forgot to announce that publicly. So this episode is kind of a farewell announcement, apology of sorts for not announcing that, but then also a nice bookend on the podcast that we started and ended with Dune 2. Mm-hmm. If a third Dune gets made, we'll have to.
Yeah, I was going to say we might have to come back for Messiah if that ever happens.
right.
I think it will happen, but it's mostly a matter of how long it will take.
I
think Denis is going to take a little break with Dune after this one.
Yeah. So the podcast will return in 2027 to discuss Dune Messiah. No promises there, but maybe we'll see.
Yeah.
Anything you want to say, Tom, about the podcast ending? I know for me, I just want to thank people for listening and kind of, you know, reiterate that, you know, we appreciate your listenership. Tom and I are still friends. We're ending on good terms. Yeah. There was no falling out or anything like that. We just kind of are moving on from this project. But yeah, is there anything that you wanted to say about it?
Yeah, I think we talked about it at length in the goodbye episode that we recorded for patrons. We might be able to see if we can make that public at some point. I think the short answer as to why we're ending it is just because we underestimated how difficult it is to get a podcast off the ground, especially if you're doing it as a side project. You know, we both have main YouTube channels that we want to spend most of our time in, and we kind of had this as a fun collaborative project on the side. But doing a podcast on the side with costs involved because we had an editor and stuff, that's very difficult. And at some point it no longer was feasible for us. And no real other reason than that. You know, we had fun doing it. We would have loved to keep doing it, but it was just too difficult to maintain. And so we're moving on and might be looking to other ways of collaborating with each other. We, you know, we do a lot behind the scenes and with each other's videos. If there's any other way that we might be getting back together, then you know that we're both open to that. So you never know.
Yes. Most likely not the end of any kind of collaboration. We still are chatting regularly, and the time that was going into this podcast is just now going into other work related to our channels. We both have other side projects that we're working on. So that those might converge again at some point in the future. We'll just have to see. But yeah, doing it weekly was taking up, I think, maybe more. The time that was going in was not necessarily justified by
how much we're spending on it.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. It was turning into a slightly expensive hobby. Hopefully people understand. And we thank you for listening and the time you spent listening to the podcast. We appreciate that. That probably says enough. We can get into one last go here, or last for now, discussing Denis Villeneuve's Dune Part 2, which Tom has been able to see twice, and I've only seen once so far. There will definitely be spoilers in this video for Part 1, probably from the beginning. So if for some reason you're listening to this and you haven't seen Part 1, maybe hold off. But there's a whole back catalog of
the Dune books. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Go back to the first episode of Cinema of Meaning, listen to all of them, and then come back here. Do you want to just start with maybe like first impressions and then go from there?
Yeah, sure. First impression, Dune 2, very, very good. Great even, I'd say. I am very glad, though, that I got to see it a second time, because I went to see it in IMAX for my first viewing. And there's just so much afterwards that's happening in your brain, because, you know, especially a movie like this, one that you've been, at least I have been, anticipating for a while. You know, I've had expectations based on the trailers that I saw. I have expectations that that were built up after seeing the first Dune. I had expectations based on what I knew from the books that I read. I had expectations based on what early reactions were saying. And so there's a lot of that going, like a lot of processing going on after an experience like this. And especially also in IMAX, you know, I love IMAX and still go to see every major film there, but I also find myself kind of being, you know, struggling a little bit with like this sort of sensory overload, but with just like having it so big in your face. I was sitting like a little bit too far in the front, so I was kind of straining my neck upwards. And the IMAX that we have, it's not a proper IMAX. I think it's one of those digital IMAXs, and especially the sound system, I think is not the best. You know, the sound is just very, very loud to the point where it becomes like too much. Especially with like Nolan's movies like Oppenheimer, every time the music would kind of crescendo, like in the beginning or the very end, we just kind of pass that threshold where it just starts to hurt my ears. And so it kind of takes you out of it instead of drawing you deeper into it. So the second time I went to see it at a sort of local, smaller art house theater, one that has like relaxing chairs and couches, like not the sort of leathery ones with the reclining, what's called like the reclining back and the front thing, but just like a proper like couch with like little pillows and stuff. So kind of a much more relaxed environment, a much more, you know, more cozy, you know, screen still big, but the sound is not that overwhelming. So I felt like there I got a better chance to really take it in more. And it is especially on that second viewing that it really, I think my first impression there of that second viewing was just how emotional it really is, much more than the first one, and how more I felt emotionally invested in the story that was going on, to the point where I was genuinely like moved at a couple of moments which I didn't really have during the first movie, even though I thought that one was very good. But yeah, overall, it's just what everyone else has already said. It's a grand science fiction experience that's unlike anything other, really, if you really think about it. Like, I watched Rebel Moon a couple of weeks ago, another like grand science fiction project, but it's just not the same after seeing Dune Part 2. Like, that's just, it's almost easy to take for granted how much you're transported into this world, and how like throughout the entire runtime I never had like for one second that I felt like, oh, I'm watching a movie. Like, it's I get that in that sense it's being compared to like The Lord of the Rings, or people are saying, oh, it's like The Lord of the Rings of our time. And I get that from the perspective of, at least from just being so invested in a story world that you're not even conscious of the movie making behind it, and that you're not really aware that you're in a story, in a theater. And that's that to me I found very valuable and entertaining, and just very moving, and in all ways, just very impactful. There's a lot of thoughts that I still have. I think coming out of part one, I kind of left my opinion or my quote-unquote judgment of that movie a little bit open-ended because I felt like a lot of part one can be made better or made worse by part two. And I think the best thing I can say about part two is that it made part one, it definitely made it better and it definitely made it feel like one cohesive story that I think I will be rewatching a lot more now that both parts are out. And I think there's still some threads left open that Dune Messiah can go into and maybe articulate a little bit more strongly, or maybe put its like definitive stamp on those aspects a little bit more. But in that sense, I think the Lord of the Rings analogy is also very fitting, in the sense that this feels like the Two Towers, in the sense that you know, the Fellowship of the Ring set the journey up, and it had a, you know, it was a bit more lucky with the structure that it had a nice climax at the end of the first novel, which the first Dune movie kind of lacked. But I think if you just see the Fellowship of the Ring and the Two Towers, you already have like the main ingredients for all like the thematic content are much more clearly laid out, and you can already kind of extrapolate where Return of the King is going, not just in terms of plot, but also in terms of like what's the meaning, what's the message here. And I think that Dune Part 2 is doing the same for Dune, basically, or the Dune, what will probably be the Dune trilogy. Like, I think this one, it builds on the first one, but it also has, I think, a much more satisfying or a much more well-rounded story to it, where you can already see the story in its fullness, even though there's still, as I said, like that extra room to articulate some stuff and to expand on some stuff. But I think right now we already have like as well-rounded a story that we can have. And yeah, that's just amazing. And I think that we're very lucky to have a movie like this, or a movie series like this, and that we are kind of getting to see it live in the theater. How about you?
I enjoyed it a lot. I liked part one a lot, especially technically. I was looking back and I think I made 4 or 5 videos about Dune. I've made one about the score, one about the editing, one about the sound design, and one about the visual effects. And I think in terms of large scale science fiction blockbusters, if you're interested in a certain type of aesthetic here, which is this kind of hard sci-fi, very like naturalistic and realistic, Denny in these movies and in some of his other movies is kind of the only one doing this kind of thing to the level that he's doing it here. There are other very impressive looking movies right now. You know, last year I also watched The Creator, which is beautiful and has a lot of beautiful visual effects. But if you want like, you know, cool pieces of technology that feel real and a world that feels like one you could actually step into, but that still feels completely original and looks incredible and sounds real and introduces you to this alien landscape that feels like truly an alien landscape that could actually exist. These movies are kind of like a height of a certain kind of technical filmmaking for me, just in terms of how well they realize that world. And part two just expanded on how well that stuff was done in the first one. It even kind of improves in some ways. Like, I think this movie is a little bit better paced than the first one. It feels like part of that's just because part one has to do a lot of the setup, but part two feels like it has more room to breathe. As much as I love the score in part one, there's less score in part two, which I think is actually good, because there's more scenes where you just feel like you're with them in the desert, like hanging out, and spending time with the characters. And I really appreciated and enjoyed that. Mm-hmm. And I love the story of Dune. I think it's an interesting, fascinating world with great characters. And so spending time in that world is great. So I think part two for me is I enjoyed it slightly more than part one. And I think in certain ways it improves on some of the, either improves on, or as you said, kind of resolves some of the issues. I think watched together, they form a much more complete piece. I also agree with your point about this being like leaving things open-ended, but also in a way that feels like a cohesive whole. Yeah. I hope we get a part three, but if these two movies are the only movies we get, I'm not going to feel like I've been left hanging and, you know, I only got a part of the story. This is kind of a complete narrative in itself. And that's, I think, going to be probably the most interesting part of this conversation, is digging into that story a little bit and what it means and what it was like to experience that. I've only seen it the once. I think I will enjoy the second watch as well. There are moments in this one, maybe we can talk about once we get more into spoiler territory, that were like some of the coolest things I think I've seen in a theater in a while, just in terms of like excitement level and stuff like that. All that said, and this is where maybe, because you talked about this, I think a little bit on the second watch, so maybe I'll get to this point more, but maybe not, I don't know. But at least having watched it once, some of my critiques about character and emotional connection that I had about the first one still stand here. I think there's an improvement, but it doesn't quite go all the way. As much as I was caught up in the world and how incredible everything looked and felt, like I still felt a kind of distance between myself and emotionally connecting to the story that's going on. You know, I think intellectually it's very interesting, but I kind of struggled to like feel super invested in like the internal struggle that's happening in Paul, for example, or something like that.
Yeah.
And some of that, I think, just comes down to the people have talked about this as being this kind of impossible adaptation, you know, and some of it comes down to just the magnitude of having to get so much story into such a small amount of space. Ultimately, it's hard to even find the time for these moments where you can have these smaller interpersonal beats play out that would create that kind of connection a little bit more, I think. But that's where ultimately, like, the Lord of the Ring, the comparison to the Lord of the Rings starts to fall apart, because if you're like holding those two in the balance, it's like the Lord of the Rings ultimately for me was all about, there's so much cool stuff going on, but it's all about how you feel, that the feeling of your connection to those characters, and that kind of feels like it takes a back seat in these movies a little bit, for me at least. There was a lady next to me in the theater who at the end of this movie was just like completely emotionally wrecked. She was like, so obviously that's not the case for everybody. That's just I was feeling watching it this time. So also I think, you read the book as well, but I was really wondering what it would be like to watch this story not knowing where it was going. I think it would be in a way a much more profound experience,
but also more strange maybe, because there's a lot of little details that you, if you know the book, you can kind of fill in the blanks that the movie leaves, whereas newcomers might be like, what the hell's that little worm and what's the blue juice coming out of it and what's happening now, like did the fetus just talk, or it does get a lot weirder.
But I
agree that it's just not the kind of story where the character struggle is necessarily central, or where you would expect the same kind of emotional response that you have for with a movie like, let's say, like All of Us Strangers, I watched recently, which is very much a very good movie also, but also very much centered around the sort of emotional experience of one person and which you then connect to and also are very moved by. I must say that it did get more emotional for me the second time around, part two. The first one, I rewatched it before I watched this part two, and I loved it more. I got more like into the atmosphere of it all than I did when it first came out, but I still didn't have like a strong emotional reaction to, let's say, when Paul's, when his father died, for example. Right. Yeah. That to me, it was a tragic moment narratively, like, but not necessarily one that I felt personally very moved by emotionally. I also didn't have that the first time I watched part two, because as I said, there was just so many expectations that I was kind of processing as I was watching the movie. I remembered feeling that the movie was kind of slow paced at first, because we were like 40 minutes into the movie and they were still like just Paul with Jessica and the Fremen, and I was like, it suddenly popped into my head like, wait, I saw in the trailer there's going to be like Fate Rada is going to be there, the other stuff, the whole gladiator scene, like, when's all that stuff happening? And he wasn't even introduced at that point, so I was like, okay, can we speed this along a little bit? Or
yeah.
But then again, I also like one other like I think probably a good example of the kind of struggle with expectations and kind of settling into what Dune is and what it isn't is that I saw some reactions beforehand that Fayette, is that how you say his name? Just Fayette Rotha?
Probably not the person to ask. I'm sure there's Dune experts out there.
Yeah. Who knows? What's the actor's name again?
Austin Butler.
Yeah. Austin Butler. Yeah. He did a very good job, by the way. But there was a lot of like praise for his character and that he was like the greatest villain since, I don't know, the Joker or something. Like they named a bunch of iconic villains and said that he was going to be like standing next to these. And then I watched the movie for the first time and I was like, okay, you know, great performance, some great moments, but his impact on this story was so small when you really think about it. Like he comes into to replace Raban at some point. I think it's sort of like the midpoint of the movie. He magically knows like where the Fremen are hiding. Like there's no real like character reason for him to be able to do what Raban up until that point couldn't have done.
Right.
And then, but to like Paul's perspective, like he's just getting attacked by the Harkonnens again. He's not specifically being challenged by Fayette, at least not in his perception at that moment. And then also by the end, like the final confrontation is between them, but it's also the first time they're meeting. So at first I was thinking like, this not, if they want to set up a rivalry here or like some, have these sort of two, because Fayette is sort of seen as, or sort of established as the other prospect of the Bene Gesserit, like the other person who could rise to what Paul is becoming. But it didn't really feel like there were these two opposing forces ascending together and reaching that ultimate conflict at the end. I kind of went in my head thinking like, oh, maybe they could have done this in a different way. Maybe this could have been done in a way where Fayette would replace Raban, like maybe in the first act already or right at the beginning of the movie, and then set up Fayette as the new sort of villain from the beginning that Paul then kind of competes with. But that, you know, there's a lot of stuff where you can sort of imagine like, oh, this could have been done better that way. But then if you think it through, you also start to notice like, wait, if they had done that, if you have like these two characters who are both equally like on the rise, you cannot have that if they're competing with each other. So if one, the ascension of one diminishes the other. So there had to be, because the first act of the movie now, I'm not sure if I'm still making sense, but I'm just going to keep going.
Yeah.
the first act of the movie, it's sort of Paul versus Raban and this clear ascension on Paul's end. Like he's becoming the Muad'Dib. He's becoming the Fremen prophet. And that's, he's becoming like a serious foil for the plans of the Harkonnens. But then Fayette is supposed to come in and he's kind of has to push Paul back. And so there's this, these mutual ascensions are kind of allowed to happen because they are separate. They have separate places in the story. And so I don't think you could have done this as well if Fayette had been there from the beginning, getting his ass handed to him by Paul in the first half of the movie.
Right, right.
And also the more important revelation I had going through all this in my head is that at the end, like, the conflict isn't like the essence of Dune, and especially also the essence of this story. It's not about Paul versus Fayette. It's not about him having a personal feud with this guy, or even having this guy as his main sort of nemesis. Like, I wrote all the conflicts down. That's like, first you have Paul and Chani as the sort of love story that kind of struggles under the weight of Paul's prophecy, and Chani kind of being skeptical about the man she loves, whether that's also the best man to lead her people. So that's an element of conflict. Then there's Paul seeking vengeance against the Baron who killed his father, conflict number two. Then there's Fayette, number three. The conflict with the Emperor, which is sort of the grander political conflict, that's number four. And then there's also the conflict with the Bene Gesserit, which is this more sort of existential conflict between those who really control, like, the flow of the universe and whatever happens, and the progress of society. And as sort of like a cherry on top, there's the little side conflict between Gurney and Raban specifically, who's also who has this little vengeance desire. And at the end of the day, like, Dune, I think, is about all of those. It's not about any one of them specifically. It's just about, I think it's also specifically about that contrast of very small individual stories playing out within these layers upon layers of there's one point in the arena where one of the Bene Gesserit characters, the new one, says, like, oh, there's plans within plans happening. And I think that's also just what Dune is. You know, it's not a character driven story in that sense, or, you know, maybe it is, but it's just like a whole lot of characters with very different class sort of statures and power dynamics, and it's actually in that sort of, if you kind of appreciate it as that, as this just this widely complex web of all kinds of interrelations, that to me is where I found the story also to become most moving, where there's that moment just before Paul realizes he has to go south. I think it's right after Fayette attacks the structure that they were hiding in. And he's kind of like genuinely saddened by that realization that he has to, that there's no choice for him but to go. And I felt like at that point, it kind of hit me, like, the way, kind of just the general sadness of these two characters, like Paul and Chani, wanting to have their love story, wanting to have, like, freedom for their people, but kind of realizing, or at least Paul realizing, that they're kind of just these puppets being thrown around by stronger forces that might eventually tear them apart and make this whole thing come crumbling down. And that, to me, I think that's where the story became most emotionally resonant with me, that there's just that, yeah, just as I said, that sort of sadness of feeling helpless and feeling powerless in what you now recognize as sort of the quote-unquote the true driving forces of the universe, and in some ways of your own life. And that's right.
So first of all, I want to kind of respond to the Fade Austin Butler stuff. And I agree. I think to recast him as kind of a larger villain within the story would change the dynamic of the story that you're talking about, where it's not really about this, there's one villain, or there's one rivalry, or there's one single point of conflict. The story is a very political one, and it's one where the lines between who's truly in power and who isn't, and who's really good and who isn't, or who's connected to whom, are all sort of tangled and gray, and those kinds of things. And so I agree with that point that you couldn't really expand Fade. And I didn't have a problem with sort of the smallness of his role in the story itself.
Yeah. And in terms I didn't either, for the record. It's just that I was kind of like wrestling with the expectations that were built up beforehand. Yes. So, yeah.
Right. Well, anyone who's proclaiming like on opening weekend that a movie character is like an all-time, all history great villain, it's like you can take solidly with a grain of salt. the hype can often overgrow the films themselves. It's fine to be excited about a movie. I'm not telling anyone they shouldn't be. But yeah, I always take opening weekend opinions with a little bit of a grain of salt. Anyway, I think I'll be interested to see how I respond to it emotionally on a second time, if I can be more invested. I think like the thing that I found myself wishing for the most was not necessarily like a different approach to any of the story beats so much as like a little more space for some of them to breathe. Like that specific one that you're talking about where Paul ends up having to decide to go south, and he's been kind of struggling with that decision. I didn't feel like that conflict had much time for me to like watch his struggle internally. It was kind of like there was a moment where he's like, I can't go south, and then like a beat or two later in the film he's like, well, I have to go south. And Chalamet is playing like the individual emotional beats well, but for that struggle to really have a certain kind of magnitude, sometimes I feel like you have to spend time with that struggle. And that was just the case for me as the movie, especially as it went deeper into the story, where there was like significant things that would happen, but it just felt like they were just flying right past, in a way that didn't allow me to like really sink into the magnitude of the significance of that moment or something. But I'm also somebody who, you know, I like a slower paced movie. I really like Killers of the Flower Moon, and a lot of people think it's too long. So, you know, I might have different expectations than those people. But I also think that's an area where like a second watch can actually change how you perceive a film, because you aren't having to like follow the steps of the plot so much, and you can just pay more attention to the emotional nuance.
Yeah, that was one thing I was going to add there, is that when I said like the first time I kind of felt the first half or so was I was kind of like anxious for it to move on to all the stuff that I'd seen in the trailer and the stuff that I knew was coming at the climax. But the second time around, I felt much more at ease with just spending that time in the desert first, watching that story between Paul and Chani unfold, which I think, especially on second viewing, does feel more weighty. Like they don't have a lot of time, as you say. There's not a lot of breathing room, but there is like the moments they do have. I think there's a lot of chemistry there between them that just naturally makes that kind of naturally sells their developing love story. And then there's that montage right after they kiss, which I think is done very well, especially also the second time around. And also kind of that sort of heightened love story also kind of hits harder emotionally when you know how it's going to fall apart towards the end. About the specific turn of them, of Paul going south, that's always one of those troubling writing issues, I think, with stories like these, where there is a character, you know, because the essence of the story is a very classic one. You know, there's a character who has seen sort of the fate that lies before him and then tries to do his best like to avoid it. But you know beforehand, as the audience, you go into the story knowing like, oh, he's going to be pushed into that direction either way. And now the question is just like, what's the thing that's going to change his mind from doing the thing he swore he isn't going to do to the thing that he now accepts as not even something that he would want to do, but something that he would see as absolutely necessary and unavoidable. And that's just, that's a hard like 180.
Yeah.
Character move to make, and hard one to sell. I think the movie does it well enough. There's that little bit with where Stilgar warns him about not listening to the desert spirits, and then what he ends up doing is listening to the desert spirit of Chamis, I think he was called. The one that Paul killed at the end of part one. And I do like that conflict of, especially the second time, I think what sold me on the character turn being at least good enough for, you know, such a difficult plot device or such a difficult character moment to do. The thing that sold me is the idea that Paul felt necessitated, or he felt it was necessary to do that because there would be certain death for him either way. Like he had these flashes of premonitions, but it was all vague and kind of jumbled and inaccurate. And so he felt like, oh, if I don't achieve like this heightened vision, or if I don't achieve this this greater prescience, then I'm going to lose Johnny for sure. I'm going to lose everyone I care about for sure. And that, I think, is also part of the tragedy, that idea that to gain that prescience is also to set himself on that path. It kind of reminded me of Nolan's recent movies, like Oppenheimer and Tenet more explicitly, but Oppenheimer also, where in Tenet there's that explicit line where, I have to paraphrase here because I don't remember it correctly, where the one character says to the protagonist something along the lines of, you know, to know the true nature of the battle is to lose it. And that's also kind of what comes back in Oppenheimer, like to create the you don't want the bomb to be created, but you also, you know, it's going to happen without you. And so, but if you do, like, it's just that idea of like, to create the information, or to conceive of the knowledge, is already to have failed in some respect, or to have already set yourself on some sort of course that cannot be diverted from. But that's all getting more already into the philosophical stuff, maybe. But
I think we can kind of jump into that section, because that's maybe the most interesting part of the discussion to me. And I think the last thing I'll say on this note is, I have high expectations for a film like this, and I think it's a really good movie, you know. But it's an interesting dynamic to me. This is just kind of an aside, but it's an interesting dynamic to me that I have different expectations for this story as a movie than I do for it as a book, because I wasn't like reading the book like with tears streaming down my face, but that's kind of what I almost expect the movie to be able to provoke me towards. So I think, you know, I can sit here and say, hey, I wish it had been more emotionally engaging or something like that, but I'm not necessarily sure even the book engaged my emotions that much more than this movie does. There's a moment that I really love in that arc with Paul and Chani, where they're sitting on a dune and she's talking about something in the past. And it cuts to a shot of spice blowing over the dunes. And it's the same shot that opens part one. That is the setup to her narrative introduction, talking about the Fremen and her people. And the audio, the voiceover audio from that introduction of part one and that scene in part two, I don't know if they shot them together, but it's very similar, like clearly evoking the introduction in that moment. And I love the idea that we're just now kind of fit, like coloring in this little gap that's suggesting that what we saw at the beginning was a story she was telling Paul somewhere on a dune they're sitting on in part two. It's just a nice little touch that I
there's
appreciate.
A lot of little visual and non-visual callbacks like that, I think, from the visions, like that, those vague visions that Paul had in part one. Like, I think the one that always kind of puzzled me a little bit was Paul seeing himself getting stabbed in the stomach or something, even though he ended up being the one who killed Chamis in that fight. But then towards the end of part two, he's the one who gets stabbed in a kind of similar manner by Fayette. So there's a lot of those little moments. And I also specifically love the one that you mentioned. And that's great.
One thing that part two gets to do, now that a lot of the setup of the world is aside, out of the way is kind of let these thematic elements really come to the surface in a really interesting way. And one of the big ones that I find most interesting is the way this story kind of deals with this dynamic of there being a sense of destiny or a sense of foresight into the future. There are these sort of spiritual forces moving in the world of Dune, but how accurate they are, or how much they can be relied on, or how in step truly they are with what is good and right, is very ambiguous. We don't ever get it. And even how real they are is ambiguous. There's kind of this constant conflict in the Bene Gesserit between, well, we are intentionally planting these ideas and manipulating people, but then you also see moments where prophecies do kind of come true, and there's no real explanation for how that happened. It didn't appear to be a manipulation of reality or whatever. Mm. So I think the way this story deals with that element is very fascinating and is kind of uniquely ambiguous. Unlike something like, for example, Lord of the Rings, where there's like clear kind of spiritual forces at play in the world, and they're very clearly designated as they appear as good and evil, and you kind of know and you see them clash. Here it's definitely a real force in the world, but how real, the characters don't really know and believe different things to varying degrees, and if that force is really like moving things towards the best outcome is also up for a kind of debate. That was one of the biggest things that stuck out to me in this part, is just kind of all of that coming to a head. And I think that's one of the more interesting underlying themes in Dune for me, is the way it handles that subject matter.
That's also one of the parts where I'm still not entirely sure what to think about it, because there's this weird tension between the idea of the Lisan al-Gahib, the kind of Paul being this prophet for the Fremen, which is explicitly stated as being the product of superstition and just empty projection onto him, and which just feeds his grandiosity, which ultimately ends up being basically nothing, just empty belief, or not empty belief, but just belief not grounded in any real thing that makes Paul actually special. But on the other hand, you have the notion of the Kwisatz Haderach, the sort of inbreeding genetic programming that the Bene Gesserit have been doing, but that does have like very real meanings. Like Paul, in that sense, he is like genuinely unique, or he stands out from everyone else. So in that sense, he is the chosen one, or not exactly, because he was kind of born a generation too soon, as was established in part one also. Because I think now that I think about it, like I think it was supposed to be Lady Jessica who was supposed to have a girl, and then Fayette Rotha was supposed to have a child, and maybe they would come together and then create the proper like Kwisatz Haderach, but now which is basically like the sort of prophet or sort of male, the first male Bene Gesserit, who would be this almost Dr. Manhattan type character who foresees both, or who can see the past and the future at once and can therefore lead humanity. But yeah, that's a very, I'm still not sure how to balance those out with each other, the sort of fake, quote-unquote fake belief of the Fremen and the very real actions that the Bene Gesserit have been doing. And so one is kind of making Paul actually unique in some ways, and the other one is just projecting not real beliefs on him. And yeah, I'm just not sure like what the idea is there. I get how it plays out with the fanaticism, and maybe also I think maybe the Kwisatz Haderach part is gonna be expanded upon in Messiah, and I think for this one it's the Lisan Al-Gaheeb which mattered the most, and just seeing how Paul became this cultural leader, or this leader of a culture, even though that's ultimately going to mean the destruction of that culture in some ways. There's some like confusion there, of not necessarily confusion there, but some aspects that I'm still not entirely sure about as to how I should kind of connect them together or place them together.
In my opinion, I think it's very intentionally ambiguous. Frank Herbert was kind of either an ecologist or anthropologist or interested in both prior to writing Dune. Dune kind of arose out of his interest in geopolitics and, you know, climate and a bunch of religions and a bunch of different things in our real world. And I think what's reflected in Dune is, I should clarify, I haven't read past the first book, so maybe some of this becomes more explicit in later books. But the impression I get from the book and then from this adaptation of the movie is that the story wants to place us kind of in the perspective that at least some people have in our real world, where you see different political forces at play. You see different ecological and environmental forces at play. There are economic forces at play in the world. And there are also different groups that believe different things about spiritual forces. And some people think that they're fake and just used for manipulation. Some people really buy into them. And some people are experiencing them in a way that feels genuinely real. And all of these things influence each other in various ways. The ecological and the spiritual and the economic are kind of not the same thing, but influencing each other. And as a single person, character within that world, trying to act within it, you kind of have imperfect knowledge. You know, you're unable to know, oh, this is what, you know, you're not given the certainty of knowing, well, it's the Bene Gesserit who are really the good ones, and they're channeling the true power that will be used for good. There's an there's an ambiguity to that. You're left kind of wondering, well, okay, the Harkonnen are definitely bad. We see them do this horrible stuff, but then the people who are opposed to them are also doing things that we might question as well. And I don't know. I think it kind of just reflects the ambiguity and the complexity of, in a lot of ways, our real world, where, you know, it's not reduced to this like simple narrative structure of, okay, we can figure out which side is right and who we should be aligned with, and know that, you know, it's like Paul himself is struggling with this idea of, am I a messiah or am I just a regular guy? And that struggle within himself is an uncertainty that he's grappling with. So, you know, I think that confusion is like a big part of kind of is an intentional feature of this story.
I don't want to spoil too much about Messiah then for you, but I have read Messiah, but I haven't read beyond it. But I do know especially in the later novels, it becomes increasingly clear, I think, that the Bene Gesserit are sort of the ultimate, the end game, not necessarily villains, but they are, they become the most thematically relevant as this sort of negative examples of how to go about things. I was thinking that there is, if I had to connect everything together, I like the way that you did it with the idea that there are these multiple different forces. I think also if I were to add on to that what Herbert would say, or would sort of add as a sort of warning to that setup or to that premise of this kind of the world we live in. We have these different forces, whether that's in our world or in this world, the Fremen superstition or the Bene Gesserit sort of eugenics. Is that the danger, I think, in both sides is just a kind of grandiosity of knowing with absolute certainty or being convinced with absolute certainty that you're on the right path, that your belief is either right or that you feel like your sort of little biological and human engineering project is going to be perfectly right. And I think I think Villeneuve is not even going to touch on this, but that's, I think, something that happens at the very end of like book five, where it really becomes more about sort of that struggle between determinism and free will, and kind of the end goal for humanity is to actually ascertain, you know, like genuine free will and just be freed from the sort of Bene Gesserit prescience and the idea that there is one person or one group of people who can foresee everything and can anticipate all your moves and therefore make you a sort of slave to their vision. And I think that's also something that, at least in part two already, we can sort of apply to the way faith or specifically also sort of the fanaticism that's taking root among the Fremen in the south, that's a danger, and that's also then reflected back on Paul. Like, how does he relate himself to it? Does he think he can steer this in a right direction, or does he, you know, or does in the face of like everything that he foresees, like he says at one point, like, I see like a narrow way through, and is that something like, is that also part of his grandiosity that he can think he can take all of this in, like consume all this, you know, he takes that water of life and then believes, okay, now I can kind of weave my way through it. And
right.
While we're already seeing like what he's sacrificing in the process, you know, he knows he's kind of knowingly lets Chani go away, or he kind of pushes her away from him, knowing like, oh, she'll come to understand eventually. Like he's no longer like in direct sort of he's not no longer emotionally connected to her, but he's already now operating from a sort of higher level of scheming that
right.
Is precisely that which was warned against and that he didn't want to do. There's a little bit of a tricky thing there, which I was going to mention earlier, is also, which I think is where Messiah will probably go into more, is that after the Paul drinks that water of life and basically gains like total prescience, or he can see like what's going to happen in the future. But I also noticed, especially the second time around, is that it's at this point that we are also, as the audience, kind of cut off from his perspective. Like at first, like throughout the story, we were seeing like the glimpses that he's dreaming about, the glimpses of the future that he has, vague as they are and incomplete as they are, like they were shared with us. But once he gains like the total omniscience, like we are also kind of pushed out of his perspective a little bit more. There's that one, when he sees, says like there's one way that he sees through, there's like one shot of him or someone being stabbed, which turns out to be himself.
Right.
Which also kind of suggests that, I think it's in the book, it's more explicit, but that the entire fight between him and Fayette was sort of a, pretty much like from Paul's perspective, like a stage play, because he knew exactly what the moves were going to be.
Yeah.
He just had to play them out according to his vision, and then he knew like which future he would unlock, basically. There is like one little moment there where he, before he gets stabbed, like he gets kicked back by Fayette and he has this genuine look of fear. He does look to Chani at that point, at which point Fayette also gets fixated on her, which I'm guessing is part of the plan. But I do, like in my personal little like headcanon, I like to believe like at this moment there was also like a genuine moment of doubt for Paul, like that he, up until that point, he may have been like, oh, I can see the future now. I can see how this plays out. I'm going to squeeze my way through this narrow path and secure our victory. But I like to believe that in that little, there's a split second there where he's like, oh shit, I might not be able to do this or to pull this off. And then, but he does in the end. So I'm not sure if that's if that's intentional there or just me projecting, but I like to believe it's that moment is there. But I think the idea here is that there is, even though we're pulled out from his perspective, I think that also maybe signifies his sort of embrace of his own grandiosity, which will be further explored in Messiah, especially the implications of that.
Yeah,
we see the implications now in a more direct sense for the Fremen and for the story, but I think the way that's going to play out personally for him and more existentially for what it means to have free will or to follow this deterministic path, both from an individual perspective as well as from a societal perspective, I think that's the bit that Messiah might provide more closure on.
One thing that really interested me was just watching the evolution of certain themes over the course of the two films. So we start out the first one with fear being talked about a lot, fear being the mind killer and fear being this thing that really needed to be resisted and overcome. And by midway through part two, Paul's already considering kind of weaponizing fear being his greatest weapon to use to accomplish his goals. Yeah, I don't know. There's several ways in which we're watching this character. There's kind of revenge in his ear and destiny and free will in another ear, and the Bene Gesserit, his mother and his mother's daughter, who is not a talking baby in this.
That was, thank God.
That was one of those decisions where, I guess Denny just decided that would be impossible to not do in a way that would make it campy.
I like the way that it made it look more like 2001 A Space Odyssey, like the star child, but then highly intelligent and being voiced by Anna Taylor-Joy. And
Paul's a character who is obviously able to accomplish what he's trying to do in this ultimately. You know, he pulls off this crazy scheme to kind of take back Arrakis. And you can find a certain triumph in that, but he also is a very sort of frail character as a protagonist who is very kind of swayed by these different influences and has a lot of inner turmoil. And it's such a, you know, for lack of a better term, it's such a kind of postmodern story compared to something like Lord of the Rings. Like, it really struck me this time around how kind of cynical I think the story is in a lot of ways, where what's at play here, there's not a lot to grab onto as a true sense of any kind of goodness. It's a lot of just power dynamics and people fighting each other for their own selfish gain or revenge, or there's these little glimpses of maybe love or connection or a desire to fight for the planet and its well-being or something like that and keep it from being destroyed. But that line at the very end where the two Bene Gesserit interact, and
the Reverend Mother says, like, I think Lady Jessica says, like, oh, you picked the wrong side.
Right.
Or is that the one you're referring to? And then the Reverend Mother, the old one, is like, oh, we don't pick sides, or there's no sides or something.
There are no sides. And that's kind of, even though she's a character, the Reverend Mother is a character who's kind of losing this battle, I think there's a sense in which she's ultimately kind of right about that in the world that we're seeing depicted here, where, like, you know, ultimately, like, I had forgotten the point from the book about Paul and Jessica being Harkonnens. And I think that's an interesting element too, where ultimately we're seeing these characters who are even in a way kind of like this horrific evil that they're kind of trying to fight back against. Like, part of them is in that, and they're fighting against that. I'm not saying like Paul and the Fremen are as bad as yet. I don't know. Maybe they become as bad as the Harkonnen. But there's this insinuation that that there's not a real distinction here to be made between the good guys and the bad guys on this broader, easy to define, you know, scale and narrative.
Yeah, that's one thing I've also been kind of struggling to find in this story, like where's like the real path towards hope, basically, because right. I do know Villeneuve has said in like interviews, like he makes very dark movies, but he needs to have hope. Like he does, otherwise it's just like cynicism and fatalism. And I'm kind of struggling also still to find that. But that's, I think, maybe the part where, unlike The Two Towers, which does end with like a glimpse of hope, and that where maybe part two of Dune that kind of ends mostly with that darkened note that there is a victory, but it's also going to be the start of a much bigger, something more destructive, and the personal relationships have suffered in the wake, or have been sacrificed completely because of it. I did a video once on Villeneuve's like broader filmography, and I think if I had to like define what it means to have hope in his stories, it comes down to characters at first like recognizing that they are not, that they're not like capable of fully sort of taming the chaos that surrounds them, and that the effort in doing so is the very thing that's probably going to lead to even more hopelessness. And so the thing that's, you know, the first step is also to kind of acknowledge that, a kind of humbling effort towards recognizing your place in the greater whole. And then maybe in that sort of limited space, then there's like room for maybe virtue, like courage, or I don't know, persistence, kindness. Also, I'm also thinking of Duncan Idaho right now in the first movie, who is the only character, I think, who gets the most explicit like heroic theme by Hans Zimmer. Like there's a few moments, if you watch the first movie again, every time he arrives on the scene, like there's I'm not sure how to describe it in musical terms, but he gets like a proper like heroic theme, whereas the other ones are all more sort of ominous and or tragic, or, you know. So I think that so far, at least, I'd say that for in Villeneuve's perspective, that maybe Duncan Idaho was the one true like heroic character, just like a sort of servant, but also one who kind of created his own position of power within that. You know, he was he was one of the most respected fighters in like the whole universe. He was like this loyal follower of the House of Atreides, and just a loyal friend also to Paul. And I'm not sure if there is like an easy, not to say that there is an easy way to find goodness and hope in this story, because it's all still set within that broader political context that, as you said, makes everything a little bit more muddy and blurry. But knowing Villeneuve's movies so far, and kind of very roughly knowing where Messiah is going in terms of the book, and where I think Villeneuve might be leading it, that's probably my best guess as to where we're going to find like hope here.
Yeah, well, I guess we might find out. It'll be interesting to see where it goes in a third. Yeah. If we get that. And I should clarify, I don't think, even if this ends up being just like a largely cynical story, I don't necessarily think that's entirely bad. You know, I like stories often that provide a glimmer of hope in the midst of the whatever darkness it's portraying. But also there's something to be said for stories that reflect sometimes what feels like the cynical reality that we live in, and seeing that on a screen or in a story or a narrative can, you know, can be a way to help you understand the world, or just even relate to the world in a different way. And then you might find the hope elsewhere. But an interesting dynamic here in this movie, for sure.
And I think, for what it's worth, I think there is real beauty to be found in the relation between Paul and Chani, even though they kind of grow apart as Paul more and more comes to embrace the other side of him or that other side of his prophecy, even though he sworn he would never go that way. And that's also what Chani tells him, like, I will love you as long as you stay who you are. Whereas Paul tells her, as long as he breathes, like, that's, there is an asymmetry there in the in the way that relationship is structured, and deliberately so, I think. But yeah, there is, I think, yeah, that's more, I guess, a more general comment on the nature of tragic stories, as you also said. Like, there can be like this sort of appreciative function to it, that you, even if you know, you know, you're kind of presented with something beautiful and then you see it destroyed or corrupted, and then, which is obviously tragic and might leave you cynical or fatalistic, but it also might lead back to you reflecting on where that initial beauty is in your life, or where it can be found, and what could have been done to preserve it, maybe, or what could have resulted in it leading it to in a different direction. But you know,
I think there's a heroic quality in her character as we see her in the film. She doesn't buy into the fundamentalist fervor about Paul, but she also genuinely loves him, but is still willing to kind of, when he has this triumphant moment at the end that is also twinged with a hint of tyranny or whatever, her not bowing to him, I think, is not just about her being upset because he's giving his hand to Florence Pugh or whatever. There's a resistance, I think, in that she is standing up against this tyrannical power-seeking element within Paul. So I do think there's something that is heroic in that character and about that move. And if Paul goes on in the coming future to become even more a villain, then her standing up against that is going to look, you know, she's going to look good. I don't know what she'll go on to do in that case, but like in that moment, at least she'll look like one of the few people who, oh, I saw this coming and I was saying, let's not do this.
Yeah. I'm not sure how that's going to play out. Yeah. But because it's a little different from the book also, the way Chani is more skeptical here.
Right. So, you know, I don't know if I'd call that hope, because ultimately her resistance is kind of ineffectual in the like grand scheme of this, the movement of all the power interacting with each other in this chaotic, whatever is happening in this movie. But it's at least a character that's giving us like the possibility that you don't have to be either caught up in the belief. I think we see a lot of things. So at the end there, we see you got people who genuinely believe he's the Messiah. You got the people who are caught up in that belief for their own cynical power games, which is Jessica, Lady Jessica. And then you got the people like the Emperor who are just bowing to a new tyrannical force to save their own skin. All of those things are suspect, you know, they're not good reasons for bowing to this person. And so there is kind of this one alternative option, which is like, you could genuinely love this person, but also be skeptical of the parts of them that you don't think are good. If anything, that's how we should approach life. But we'll see if, you know, this movie certainly doesn't present that as like, if you do that, you're going to change the world and fix everything. It's more like, if you do that, you might be right, but stuff is still going to go down the way that it's going to go down.
Yeah, I think that's going to be sort of, I hope at least that Messiah is going to make that more sort of the central conflict, that idea that, which to compare it to Oppenheimer again, like I felt like in Oppenheimer, there was this strong sense that Oppenheimer would have created the bomb, like no matter what, or that the bomb would have been created no matter what Oppenheimer chose to do. Like if he didn't do it, then maybe the Nazis would have done it first, or then eventually the Soviets would have done it. And so there's this tragedy there, thinking about like, are we really are we just like, are we like a significant force in the broader movement of time and history, or is, are the things that gonna happen, are they gonna happen anyways? And so I wonder, like, to what extent Dune is gonna explore the idea that maybe we can have like all this, the just the weight of this sort of destiny, like in this case, or in the case of Oppenheimer, the destiny of the atomic bomb coming into existence. And is there still space for an individual to kind of change the direction of how that unfolds, or position themselves in such a way towards it that we can make a meaningful difference? Or are we just, or should we just completely like surrender ourselves to whatever is going to happen? That I think is going to be that sort of fundamental conflict in, it is already to some extent in part two, but I think even more so in Messiah. And I'm curious to see how that's going to play out.
Yeah. Me too. It's a relevant question for our time because we have people building things right now that they believe might destroy the world, but also, they also think it's going to help people, and they think they can find that narrow path between between the two, where we do the right thing and accomplish our goals and survive and don't destroy humanity in the process. And I think there's a lot of hubris involved in thinking that you can thread that needle.
Yeah, it's a very Western perspective, I think, also one that we take for granted, that this is just how history works and that this is how human beings have always worked. But I think it's also very much a Western modern perspective, also the idea that nothing is sacred and basically everything is up for grabs or up for manipulation or progress or violation or whatever. Whereas I think there used to be and still are cultures where there are genuinely things that are sacred, which we also saw in Dune with like the Fremen. They had like genuine places and rituals and just parts of their being that are sacred and not in danger of being corrupted, therefore. And I think that's something that also, that's kind of like the colonial perspective, I think, that is also at the heart of Dune, where Paul kind of brings his more modern, more disenchanted, more westernized perspective into that world, and eventually leads to the Fremen kind of abandoning their own ways, not as explicitly in this movie, but in the book more so. And later on, you know, it's almost it's a little bit unintentionally funny moment at the end of part two where the Fremen just get on in the spaceships like straight away. There's no hesitation about them moving into like leaving their home planet and just going up into the stars, even though they've never been there or not, don't know anything about it. But it does signify, like in very brief moment, maybe a little bit too brief, that they're kind of ready to abandon their own culture, which we also saw earlier, by the way, in one of my favorite scenes, by the way, where Paul is going up to speak in the south and he has to kill Stilgar first, because that's the way, like, he has to be a leader in order to talk. And then he's just like straight up, no, I'm the one pointing the way, like that already is like, it's in that moment that the Fremen sort of surrender their culture to the idea of the prophet or the coming of the Messiah. And that's, I think, also a pivotal scene where you can literally see that corruption happening. And I think it's just fascinating also. And it's just very well done.
I think that's probably a good place to wrap it up, unless there's anything else significant you wanted to touch on.
I think I've covered everything and I wanted to say about it more, probably.
there's nothing to pitch here at the end. We don't have a future episode or anything for you to sign up for. You know, we both still make videos on our channel, so you can go watch those. I'm sure there will probably be some Dune Part 2 videos coming eventually from one or both of us. Stay tuned there, and maybe in a few years when Dune Messiah is back, we'll come back and do another one of these. But also maybe we'll potentially do some kind of collaboration before then. So keep your eyes peeled. Yep. We'll we'll be around, and we appreciate everyone who's been listening this whole time.
Thanks.